This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We created the problem 30 years ago when we took a liberation movement who had no skills and experience in governance and put them in the deep end.
That's South African businessman Mansour Sheikh Imam, who leads the Allied Movement, on the problems that have developed since the African National Congress took power at the end of apartheid. Details coming up. Also, South African rescuers are searching for 49 missing people in the rubble of a collapsed building. And an anti-graft agency says Nigeria's banks are responsible for 70% of financial crimes in the country. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. U.S. President Joe Biden has been in contact with Jordan's king and Israeli's leaders in an apparent effort to soothe tensions and possibly stave off a planned Israeli ground assault on the Gaza city of Rafah. A flurry of diplomatic activity has been focused on working out a ceasefire between Israel and the militant Hamas group. Israel wants to release the hostages taken by Hamas 7 months ago, while Palestinians want humanitarian aid. Israel's military has told Rafah residents to evacuate. We have on the phone a VOA White House correspondent, Anita Powell, to discuss the situation. Welcome to African News Tonight.
Thank you so much, Yehia.
So, Anita, what is the White House doing now?
I would liken this to when you see a duck paddling on the water and you see everything looks smooth on the top, and under the water, the duck is paddling frantically. Those feet are moving. Mm. This is basically what's happening yesterday and today at the White House. A flurry of calls. As you mentioned, yesterday, President Biden lunched with King Abdullah of Jordan, during which the Jordanian monarch really pressed President Biden to urge the Israelis to call up their ground operation and to let in humanitarian aid. Meanwhile, we also have these ongoing ceasefire negotiations that are brokered by the Qataris and the Egyptians. And the Americans are, of course, involved in that, but they're not the direct negotiators here. And so that's also in flux. And so there's a lot going on under the surface. And when we ask White House officials about this, they say, you know, we don't want to get ahead of the process. This is a very delicate stage. And so we're not hearing a lot now about the nitty-gritty that's happening behind closed doors in Cairo or maybe in Tel Aviv or even here in Washington. But they are assuring us that there's a lot of activity and they have these goals.
But where does the administration stand on Rafah?
President Biden has been very clear on this. He has used repeatedly, and he and other administration officials have used the word mistake to describe Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plan to mount a ground assault on Rafah. Now, yesterday, John Kirby, the National Security Council communications advisor, kind of split hairs and said a ground invasion is not the same as an aerial bombardment, which is what we're seeing a little bit of in Rafah now. I hesitate to say a little bit of because for the people who are under that ground assault, that's a very big deal. But we are seeing some kinetic activity in Rafah right now, but it is not the ground assault that Israel is planning. But President Biden and his administration have been really clear in saying, yeah, no, that's a mistake. We don't believe that it's going to achieve the goals, and it's going to be too endangering for the more than 1 million civilians who are huddling there, cowering under the threat of this assault.
And we mentioned the Jordan and the king. Any details on Biden's meeting with Jordan's King Abdullah yesterday?
I wish I could tell you what the two gentlemen had for lunch. I don't have that. What I do know is that they had a very private discussion over lunch at the White House, and they mainly discussed the situation in Gaza. Now, this is important to Jordan because, of course, there are about 2.3 million Palestinian refugees in Jordan. But additionally, a huge population in Jordan is of Palestinian descent, including its queen, Queen Rania. So this hits very close to home for Jordanians, and of course the Jordanians have an interest in this situation being resolved in a way that is peaceful. I will mention one other thing that the Jordanian king brought up, which is they need a sustainable, credible path to Palestinian statehood. That feels very far away today, considering that we have all of these balls in the air and, you know, kinetic activity in Gaza today. But that is what the king pressed for with President Biden.
VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell, thanks for your input.
A pleasure as always.
Hundreds of political parties and independent candidates have registered for South Africa's election on May 29th. Most have no chance of winning a seat in parliament, but some political analysts say the record number indicates a healthy democracy, even as Africa's most developed economy faces multiple crises. Darren Taylor reports.
115 political parties and 220 independent candidates are contesting a poll some analysts forecast will be the most competitive since South Africa's historic first multiracial election in 1994. That election ended apartheid and saw Nelson Mandela's African National Congress, the ANC, surge to power. Now, however, surveys show growing numbers of South Africans blame the ANC for corruption, violent crime, high unemployment and poverty, and long water and electricity outages. Most surveys indicate the ANC will get about 45% of the vote, which would mean losing the absolute power it's held for three decades. It still could hold on to the government by forming a coalition with smaller parties. The opinion polls show the next biggest party, the Democratic Alliance, registering around 22% of the vote, and the Economic Freedom Fighters taking 11%. One of the many tiny parties promising to improve South Africa is the Allied Movement for Change. Durban businessman Manzoor Sheikh Imam leads the Allied Movement.
We created the problem 30 years ago when we took a liberation movement who had no skills and experience in governance and put them in the deep end and expect them to run a country as large as South Africa. Given the inequalities of the past, we actually received a bankrupt state.
Another small party hoping for a seat in parliament is Sizwe Uma Nation, the Sun Party. It's led by businessman Rashid Gutta.
This country is well endowed with mineral resources and raw materials. We have the skills in this country, but they're aging because the factories have closed. So the people that are left now, the skilled people, are between the age of 60 to 70 years old. So we need to come with an aggressive plan to do on-the-job training and transfer the skills to the younger people. We have to start incentivizing people to start opening factories. We must put on taxes for these type of raw materials to discourage people from exporting the raw and incentivize them to export the finished product.
Surveys show that of the smaller parties, former ANC leader and president Jacob Zuma's Umkhonto we Sizwe, or MK, poses the greatest danger to the ruling party. The polls indicate MK could take 10% of the national vote, with most of its support coming from people who traditionally back the ANC. In Johannesburg, Leopold Mazibuko is one of many prospective voters who agree with policies put forward by smaller parties. But Mazibuko says come election day, he'll probably vote for one of the famous parties. He says he's going to be confused by all the names and faces on the ballot paper. They're all promising all kinds of things, and it's easy to forget who said what. Mazibuko says he knows broadly what three of the big parties stand for, so he'll end up voting for one of them. It's easier. Politics professor at the University of South Africa, Dirk Kotzer, says with a vast plethora of parties up for election, he doesn't blame voters from being overwhelmed. But he adds, the fact that so many organizations and individuals raised the funds to register for the election shows that democratic politics in the country is a vast landscape. even if victory likely will go to the bigger players. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And in more news from South Africa, rescuers today combed the rubble from an unfinished multi-story that collapsed in the South African city of George, killing 5 people and leaving 49 unaccounted for. The French news agency AFP reports 26 people have been rescued in the picturesque coastal city of George. A construction crew of 75 people was at the site at the time of the collapse Monday. No cause has been determined. Egyptian businessman and Sinai militia leader Ibrahim al-Organi has been appointed head of Egypt's Arab Tribes Union, a paramilitary entity uniting 5 tribal groups under one umbrella to confront national security challenges and respond to what the announcement said were campaigns of lies and rumors. Broadcast on Egyptian intelligence-owned TV channels, the lavish celebration marking the creation of the entity featured militiamen in uniforms resembling those of the Egyptian army. Several public figures and national legislators attended the ceremony. Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at Egypt-Japan University, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi why these announcements sparked fear on social media that it could repeat Sudan's conflict between national troops and a militia force.
As you know, Egyptian borders are on fire, Sudan, Libya, and Gaza. So boosting border defense by co-opting tribes on borders is cheaper and better than involving regular armies, which may have frictions with the local tribes and the customs. Already, Mr. Organi and his people were used in fighting the terrorist upsurge in North Sinai. And so this is a continuation of this cooperation between the standing army and this tribal formation. The critics exaggerate the role when compared with the Russian Wagner or the Sudanese rapid deployment force because different armaments. The central government in Egypt is very old and cannot be compared to, with the Sudanese. Also, the arms that they have, the tribes in Egypt, are light type. They don't have air defense or drones or any of this type sophisticated weapons. Egyptian tribes historically have always had light arms, not jets, not missiles. The controversy arose because of 2 factors. One is bad media presentation of the whole project by pro-government media officials, and fears that the modern state is using people with murky past as allies sanctioned by the regime. And so this, of course, alarmed a lot of intellectuals about this kind of cooperation.
Pro-government talk show host Mustafa Bakri, who was appointed as a spokesperson for the new entity, praised the appointed head of the Arab Tribal Union as a hero, as he led, as you said, the Union of Sinai Tribes, a pro-government paramilitary group set up in 2015 to support the Egyptian army in battles against a local offshoot of the Islamic State. But some Egyptian commentators describe this union as a rogue entity and an illegal outfit. What's your take on that?
As you know, tribes and Bedouins are only 1% of the population of Egypt, but they are very much located in geographic area on the borders. So this is their importance. So any Bedouin formation contradicts the idea of a modern state. Hence, the alarm sounded by some Egyptian intellectuals who saw this step as a potential decline in the power of the central government by using a tribal structure doing the job of the state, while others saw the whole process is a complementing and continuation of the current situation that happened in North Sinai. And this is why you have this debate between the two sides.
VOA reported last month that a travel agency called Hala, owned by Al-Organi, charged $5,000 per adult to arrange for Palestinians to escape Israel's war on Gaza and cross to Egypt. When Egyptian journalists organized a protest in front of their union chanting against this practice, the police arrested them. What do you make of that?
There is lack of transparency in Egypt, in Egyptian politics in general. The ranking of press freedom in Egypt is now about 170. Rule of law is also very low, and protests are contained in universities and trade unions. So this arrest of journalists regarding Organi contributed to this general public suspicion of him and his tribal structure. It also confirmed that he must be enjoying strong support from the security establishment, hence they are protecting him. As you know, Sinai cannot be accessed without security clearance, and this man could not have done anything without a green light from the security.
That was Said Sadiq, Professor of Political Sociology at Egypt-Japan University, speaking to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs, and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Nigeria's banking sector is responsible for 70% of financial crimes or fraud perpetrated in the country, according to the Anti-Graft Agency, the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, or EFCC. The agency made the assessment during a summit in March. Every year, Nigerians report tens of thousands of fraud cases to authorities. In 2021, for instance, nearly 140,000 cases were recorded, the highest in 4 years, the EFCC reported. The agency said it's working to counter the trend. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
In April 2021, Uche Ohiri learned about an agribusiness scheme that offered to pay up to 30% interest on investment in 4 months. She took the bait and invested $550, but the company shut down soon after and its founder vanished into thin air.
I tried to log in. I had access to the website. I could see the fund. I could see the interest, but I could not do anything.
Like Ohiri, hundreds of investors who lost their monies reported the company to the police. But they found out via news reports that the same firm had been accused of a $70,000 bank loan fraud in connivance with corrupt bank officials. The bank in question, though, denied any wrongdoing.
It was a joke at first to me because it has never happened to me. You guys got to be kidding me. But unfortunately, it wasn't a joke.
Fraud is on the rise in Nigeria's financial system. Nigerian institutions have lost $201 million to fraud since 2020, according to the Financial Institutions Training Center, a research and advocacy organization. Experts say growing electronic payments and less stringent verification standards are making local targets more vulnerable to fraud, and that financial institutions are often unable to thoroughly probe fraud cases due to poor information sharing and lack of coordination. Isaac Butty is a public finance analyst.
The system is designed in such a way that its attempts to address corruption is superficial. We need structural strengthening, institutional strengthening, such that, not just institutional, even process strengthening, such that any conduit pipe for corruption is blocked.
The consulting firm KPMG says only 30% of Nigerian banks have fully implemented anti-fraud measures that allow mandatory verification of the customer's identity before opening an account. In 2021, the central bank asked bank customers to report unauthorized debits to its customer protection desk. Last year, President Bola Tinubu launched an anti-corruption campaign and called for support. And in January, Nigeria's Independent Corrupt Practices Commission, ICPC, and the EFCC said they are teaming up to fight corruption. Secretary of the ICPC, Clifford Okparodu, spoke during a separate meeting in the capital.
We have our own constraints, just like every other organization. But we know that as a commission, that everybody's eyes on the commission. We have been doing our best. We have a good team.
But Boti says words must be matched with action.
Corruption is systemic. Then we need a more systemic approach to fighting it. So with all of the initiatives that we have on ground, we need to begin to deploy these things in a truthful manner.
Nigeria has until May next year to address financial crimes, including terrorism financing, or risk being excluded from the global financing system. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
There are 6 months left in the U.S. presidential race between Democratic President Joe Biden and Republican candidate Donald Trump. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns looks at what is ahead for the campaigns in the run-up to Election Day.
President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump have 6 months left to persuade American voters to give them a second term. Trump will spend some of that time in state or federal court, answering 4 separate indictments on charges that include unlawful retention of national defense information and falsifying business records. He says prosecutors are interfering in the election.
Everything was legal, and they're doing this because it's for politics. They want to get Biden elected. That's the only reason.
The court appearances are reducing Trump's time campaigning, but he says what he calls a political hoax is only making him more popular with voters.
It's a terrible, terrible thing happening in our country, and hopefully November 5th, the most important day in the history of our country, in my opinion, that's called Election Day, hopefully it's going to change because these people are destroying our country.
The Republican Party last nominated Trump for president at its semi-virtual 2020 convention in North Carolina. This year's Republican convention is in July in the state of Wisconsin. Before then, Trump will need to choose a new running mate. Among those he's believed to be considering for vice president are Florida Senator Marco Rubio, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, and New York Representative Elise Stefanik. As the incumbent president, Biden has the advantage of White House events to keep voters' attention. On the campaign trail, Biden is becoming more pointed in his attacks on Trump while claiming credit for a stronger economy.
Construction of new factories has more than doubled in our administration. Meanwhile, Donald Trump still thinks windmills cause cancer. That's what he said. And by the way, remember when he was trying to deal with COVID, he said, just inject a little bleach in your veins. He missed it. All went to his hair.
The Democratic Party last nominated Biden for president at its semi-virtual 2020 convention in Wisconsin. This year's Democratic convention is in August in the state of Illinois. Biden is running again with Vice President Kamala Harris, who's been campaigning for restoring federal abortion protections that were ended when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the case Roe v. Wade in 2022.
Donald Trump was the president who took away the protections of Roe. Joe Biden will be the president who puts the protections of Roe back in place.
Before November's Election Day, Biden and Trump are expected to debate. Both men say they're ready. No date's been set. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Togolese President Faure Gnassingbé has signed a controversial new constitution that eliminates presidential elections. Opponents say the move will allow him to extend his family's 6-decade-long rule. Parliament will now have the power to choose the president, doing away with direct elections. The Associated Press reports that Gnassingbé signed the constitution late yesterday, just days after the election commission announced that his ruling party had won a majority of seats in parliament. Gnassingbé has ruled Togo for nearly 20 years after taking over from his father. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Wahib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Kayla Williams, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.